the other night I had something happen that was really wild. It was like an orb. It was purple. It was small. And it was centered on a plant. It was like, it was one of those little plant spirits. I don't know what you would call them. Mm-hmm. The fae, the fairies. I don't know. It was a purple orb. And I saw it in three dimensions, 2 feet in front of my own eyes. I went, oh, so that's what these things are that people talk about. And it was a beautiful, that purple was just beautiful. So I said, hi.
Reconnecting with J.M. DeBord because he's gone beyond dreams. Now he's gone into the science of the paranormal. New book, fantastic. Love it. Wrote a review. I can't say enough nice things about it. It covers the entire spectrum of what we consider PSI. What was the motivation?
You know, Wendy, it seems like it was almost like synchronicity or fate that this book ended up in my hands as the author. You know, the way it worked was a contract came through my agent. The publisher was looking for basically a writer for hire. And my agent said, hey, I've got this on my desk. They're looking for someone to write this book. And it's about the science of the paranormal. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, this is, you know, I've been into this stuff for years, listening to your show, listening to Jeff Mishlove, reading books, subscribed to subreddits. It's always been a fascination of mine. So when they said, we want an author to write this book about the science of the paranormal, I said, yeah, sign me up. But I also knew that it felt like synchronicity in the sense of something wanted this book to be written in the right way, not just to sort of gloss over things, you know, to go into the sort of depth and to lead readers on a journey to show them that there really is a science of the paranormal, that there's been great research done over the past 150 years that some of the names that were involved, especially in the early days, we have Nobel Prize winners, we have Harvard professors, and then later you had like the PIR lab at Princeton Engineering, an anomalous research lab headed up by Robert Johns. This was the dean of engineering at Princeton who stepped up to the plate and said, if there is such a thing, as he was studying psychokinesis, but he also got involved in remote viewing and precognition. He said, if there is such a thing, I want to be able to prove it to my colleagues, my peers, other engineers and scientists. So he set up these really great experiments, gathered tons and tons of data. And in the end, what they came up with was what they thought was very highly suggestive evidence that there really is this mental effect that people have on their environments, whether it's through psychokinesis or precognition, picking up information from the future, telepathy, being able to communicate mind to mind. So I knew all of this, but I knew that most people out there didn't really know anything about it. So I considered it to be my job or even my mission to present it in a way that would be a fun book, but also has the sort of depth so that if somebody says, I want to see the science of the paranormal, not just the paranormal, that they would find it in my book. And apparently, Wendy, did I succeed at that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing I really like about it is when I look at stuff and it's really cold and numbers oriented and math and okay, here's the science, here's the research, I don't get drawn into it. What I saw at the very beginning was the boots on the ground action from people who have incredible abilities like Alex Tanis. And you know, I love Alex. He's one of my favorite psychic who had all sorts of corroboration and the foundation is still active. And when you're talking about him with bilocation, that was like a slam dunk.
Well, thank you for making me aware of him because it was because I heard about him through you that he was on my radar. The publisher gave me this parameter. They said, we want you to use pop culture references to things that are depictions of psychic and paranormal to, you know, because this is our audience. These are the people who are attracted to this series of books that we've put out, which are the science of. They did one on the science of UFOs, and then they've got a bunch of others. So this is part of a series, and it's all based on these pop culture references. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, we could use a Star Wars reference. It hasn't been overdone. oh, that's right. There's that scene where Luke Skywalker is, you know, in two places at once. And I remember talking about that and hearing online discussions about it where people were like, well, how could he be on this planet somewhere where he's projecting this image of himself into the battle scene in that movie? And I was like, well, yeah, actually, Alex Tanis did that. And I remembered his account of him going into a sort of a meditative state. He said he was between classes. Mm-hmm. He was teaching college classes, and he was between classes, and he took a nap. And next thing he knew, he found himself in another place. And that there were people who vouched that he showed up at their door, and not only showed up, but drank some tea. So if that is like a, you know, a phantasm or a ghost, like, no, it's not. He was physically in two places at one time. So how does that work? So that's what I used to draw people into the story. And I knew when I was writing that I was like, yeah, I know one person out there who is going to love that I opened up the book with Alex Tanis.
Yes.
So
yes, that's
me. Thank you for putting him on my radar. I've run across so many others from listening to, you know, your podcast and Jeff and others that I know some of these people almost by, I mean, I know them by name, but I almost feel like I know them personally. People like Ingo Swann, and you've mentioned him many times before. Mm-hmm. He was already on my radar, but I had a familiarity with him because I've heard so many interviews either with him, like when he's been on Art Bell's show, you know, I've read his books. I've read other people's references to him. And so I'm just so thankful that I had that base of knowledge to work from and that I could introduce readers to these people. Because when you say, oh, psychic and paranormal, a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's a bunch of BS. There's no proof to it. And I'm like, no, actually, these people have been tested in laboratories. They've participated in the research. They've made these great contributions and they've demonstrated it over and over again that they can do it. So these names, these people, I wanted to make the readers familiar with them and kind of, you know, to kind of get to know them. It's like you said, it's if a book is all about dry numbers and facts and stuff like that, it's just, you know, it's not that interesting. But when we get involved with people and their stories, I think that's what makes a book really compelling. So that's what I tried to do.
Again, pulling in the pop culture, like starting with that in terms of Luke Skywalker and being able to bring that into this is how it works and this is how it might have worked. And there are other stories like that. I remember I wanted to talk with the son of the guy who did Walking Through Walls. And that's because he did the same thing. And what they would do, and there's some other stories of how they lock themselves into a room, don't bother me, that kind of thing, and I'm going to check out for a while or check in somewhere else. And so this is a way of seeing this is how it's done. This is what people do. And if they can do it, we can do it too. And that's what I like about this book is giving these kinds of characters some kind of a platform. Like when you went and you found John Chang, that's one of the standout videos, I think, on the internet. When they did this little documentary and found a guy who is an incredible chi master, and it's got the name, he's deceased now, but watching him work with the acupuncture and finding out more about these kinds of people through your writing, it says this is real. This isn't fiction. This isn't some kind of fantasy. These are real people who do real extraordinary things.
That was in the documentary, The Ring of Fire. And the people who were the documentarians worked for years to get him on camera to demonstrate things that he could do. He was very shy about it. He wasn't looking for publicity. He wasn't looking for exposure. In fact, when he started getting exposure, it made him shy away. They never got him back on camera again because after the video footage got out of him doing, you know, lighting the newspaper on fire, John took this. They called him John. His name is something else in his native. I think he was Malaysian. He crumpled up a piece of newspaper and with multiple cameras running, he set it down on the ground and he did his chi thing, like directing energy into the paper and it caught fire. Now, there is an old sort of parlor magician's trick with that where you can use a chemical reaction. You hide a little bottle of something up your sleeve, you know, and you're actually pouring the chemical onto the paper, and that's what ignites that's what ignites it. There is a way of faking it. But what you can't fake is that the brothers who did the documentary went to him in the first place because one of them had a bad eye infection. And as John was working on him in this treatment room, you could see the man's body twitching involuntarily. And then you hear him say, yes, I was feeling this energy going through my body. It was making all of these involuntary reactions. And it fixed the eye infection. You know, you're a Westerner and you're in some country where you don't have access to normal Western healthcare. What do you do? So they went to a guy who was locally known for being able to do this kinds of energy healing. This kind of stuff isn't necessarily proof as far as Western science is concerned. You know, they want to see the replicability. They want to have it under these tightly controlled conditions. One of the things I found is that even when those demonstrations were done under controlled conditions, they satisfy the requirements of science as a discipline. The mainstream science still didn't accept the results. So they set up this high bar for parapsychology, the study of the paranormal, of the psychic. And then when researchers actually met that bar, they still did not accept the results, at least not as far as a community, not as far as the mainstream mm-hmm. science goes.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring these other, to put a combination of both those studies that did, you know, we're in a lab and we're going to build up the numbers and we're going to, you know, give you the data and we're going to run the analysis on it. And, you know, you've got that side of it, the published research side of it, but you also have the people who've experienced this for themselves. And I think that in the end, that we have to sort of open up a little bit when we study phenomena of consciousness, because it's not always demonstrable or demonstrable in a laboratory. You know, you can't always get the kind of data that would hold up as far as published research in the journal Nature or something like that. But you can get evidence that would hold up in court. And so that was why I tried to combine the two together into the book and give, you know, accounts like John. It was fascinating. And the video is right there on YouTube. You can watch it for yourself. Is the guy faking it? Well, that's what, you know, the people who defend materialist science and who defend this position that there is no science to this. There's no proof. There's no evidence. It's all fakery. Whenever there is evidence presented to them, like the videos, what I read was they said, well, they didn't film from behind, so they didn't have all the angles down. So it is still possible that this guy was doing some kind of fakery. So therefore, this video is worthless as far as science is concerned. And Wendy, it really makes me think that maybe we don't need to wait anymore for the mainstream scientific community to give their stamp of approval to this stuff and say, yes, at least some of it has been demonstrated to be very likely to be a real phenomenon. We maybe need to start looking into this for ourselves a little more, or coming up with some kind of different standards. Because one of the points I make near the end of the book is that there are groups within the military and intelligence in the U.S. and in other countries that for at least the last 50 years have already stepped beyond where mainstream science is. And they're actually operational with this stuff now, such as precognition, telepathy, remote viewing. They are and have been doing this stuff at the highest level, special forces, SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, the original work that came out from, you know, Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ with Ingo Swann and the other remote viewers, that they showed that these people really can do what they said that they did. Even though the numbers in the end were disputed by the scientific community when they published in places like Nature and IEEE, you know, prestigious journals, the mainstream community knocked that stuff down and created a huge roadblock to other scientists actually looking at this and going, oh, wow, there is something here. They really did do this. So the fact is that, you know, mainstream science has this big constipation as far as processing through all of this information and data, and then coming up with something and saying, yeah, actually, if you have your mind open and your eyes open, you can see that this really has been demonstrated to a level that would satisfy the requirements in almost any other field of science. So, for example, there is a sigma as a measure of the statistical power when you put data together and you say, is there something here? Has the effect been captured by the data that we're looking for? When it comes to demonstrating the Higgs-Boson, you know, particle, the existence of this thing, it comes in at a power of 5 sigma, which is basically where you come up with enough statistical power to say that there is a real thing happening here. We really have found the Higgs boson. Well, the telepathy studies for Ganzfeld, when you do the same sort of meta-analysis of the data, comes up at 5.5 sigma. So it actually has more statistical power than the data that we've accepted for the existence of this particle in physics. So you're going to tell me that you'll take less statistical evidence to accept this thing over here because it's coming out of a very, you know, billions and billions of dollars that have been put into this field of studying physics, of particle physics. But over here, we've got this equally large accumulation of data and experiments, and you won't accept it, even though it has more statistical proof of the existence of, in this case, telepathy. So there is a hypocrisy to this. And I found that the people who are really putting this into an operational, they're using it. Like the group Skywatcher, they're using these, they call them psionics. They are people who have a natural psychic sensitivity. They're recruiting them into a program that originated out of a special forces operation group. You know, these people deal in reality. You know, if it didn't work, do you think after all these years that they'd still be trying?
Yeah.
So in a way, mainstream science is what's holding us back because they won't give their seal of approval. But an end run has been made around them by these other groups. And I think that that's a fact that needs to be more widely disseminated out there because people are still going based off of the impression they have that the science hasn't proved anything. There is no science, the paranormal, they haven't proved anything, blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, you can believe that and you can have your reasons for believing it, but let's go talk to these guys over here who are these special forces operators who are using this operationally in the field, and let's talk to them about whether they think it's true or not, and you'll get a very different answer.
Well, I think they don't worry about the science. They just do it. Does it work? Does it work? Can it be reproducible? And for them, it can. And they've got documents to prove that. I've interviewed a couple of remote viewers. Well, actually more. I think Angela Thompson-Smith. I've also interviewed Paul, both Joe McMonagall and Paul Smith are in the archives. And so these folks, they're telling you what they do and how they do it and how it's easy. And if you just, even when I spoke with Julia Mossbridge about doing this, she had me do a demonstration and I was shocked that it was so quick. I was like, she said, here's this. And, you know, tell me what you see. And I drew the picture. I was like, wow. Okay. That was something that had to do with greenery, vines growing somewhere, and that's what I came up with. And so the fact that it's so accessible lets us know that we don't have to wait for the science. We have to, I think, look at the people who have given us some results and then take that as some kind of an incentive to say, well, what can I do? How can I do this? And you do this with this book. It's basically what I think is the premise for the science is that it is impossible. Whatever these things, well, as soon as they're saying it is impossible, then they're proving whatever method they choose to adopt that it is impossible. And that's what James Randi was perfect at. Everything is impossible. Nothing is possible. And then he set out to affirm his confirmation bias. Okay, that to me, that's not science. That's bias. And it's inherent in the language that's being used. This is impossible. So going around that, well, what isn't impossible? Then we go forward with what if? And instead of immediately saying, no, it can't work. Okay, well, then you can prove it can't work. Now, prove to me it can work. Let's go forward. And then you're seeing the people who do it. Well, there's proof right there. It can work. Some of that, when you're the people that you're including, I love the one. This is, I don't know how to pronounce the last name, Thomas Cotonou, Intelligent Electrical Energy. harnessing it for healing. I love that section.
He was a Brazilian, if I remember correctly. He was the Brazilian guy who could do, he demonstrated a group of parapsychologists with, there were other types of, there was like an engineer and there were some others. They went down to actually see him in action. And they witnessed things happen around this guy that were, we would say it was impossible. This is stuff that's right out of, you know, the movies kind of thing. And you're looking around going, okay, where's the special effects guy? Because I just watched, you know, this kitchen utensil twist up into a, you know, this piece of metal with the guy not even touching it in some cases, just in his presence, because he created such a strong field around him that these objects and people responded to him. The intelligent energy of healing. I think that's how he originally got known, was because he was a healer. Yeah, I really dug deep, Wendy. And it was fascinating because I found these people in the published literature, even with my background of, you know, having been interested in this for a long time, I still didn't know about people like Thomas. So when I dug into the published literature, I went, oh my gosh, you mean this is out there? I mean, it may not be in the biggest journal in the world, but this was still written up for other scientists,
yeah,
other people who study this stuff. And yeah, I found that stuff to be fascinating.
For me, it strikes a chord because he talks about the energy healing, and when he's doing something that's mending a bone or mending something, he sees a blue energy around that fragment. And so it's showing something that other people can witness as this is being done. The electrical thing, that's what I, that's my focus with the night lights and all that other stuff. This stuff is real. And for people to be able to see some kind of an effect, a result, is huge. There's another thing about that too, that I think the researchers who were studying him also say that they found that 19 of 23 children with psychic gifts had previously survived electrical shock, and he had been hit by lightning.
Yeah.
And so when I was a kid, I stuck my finger in a light socket just because. This is why you should have them covered, okay? Just so you know, it was behind the toaster. I wanted to know how the toaster works, so I put my finger there, and it turned black. I'm okay, I think. But it might be, you know, something that it might have. I thought, whoa, I remember when I was a kid that I had this shock. And I don't remember if my mom knew about it. I know my finger was black, so and I think it made a sound. I think it caused a short. But, you know, as a kid, who cares? Those aren't my problems. It was a quick,
and it seems to rewire the, and it rewires your nervous system in some sort of way that opens you up to discovering these things for yourself. You know, a lot of these people, when you look into their biographies, you find that at a very young age, they experienced something that let them know that there is more to this world than just the way that physical materialism presents it, that everything works according to the laws of physics, and anything that doesn't, can't be explained through physical materialism cannot exist according to that paradigm. But then you have people like you have people like Alex, you know, who had his experience as a young boy jumping off the stairs. He turns around after jumping. He's just goofing around, jumping up and down the stairs. And he looks back at the top of the stairs. He sees another version of himself. He calls it Alex number two. But he saw himself from that other perspective. He saw himself at the bottom of the stairs where he had just jumped and landed. Then he turns around and he sees himself at the top of the stairs, but from that perspective, he realized that he was in both places at once. So once you've experienced it for yourself, then there's not this question anymore of, is it real? It's, you start asking questions like, well, then how does it work? How can I use this for my advantage? How can I use it for my family and friends? What can I do with this? What kind of interesting things can we get into? And this is where I found in the science, where there are more and more people who have a background, maybe even up to the PhD level, who have experienced these things and are now trying to prove it to their colleagues, maybe not necessarily who don't believe, but just to put the evidence out there. There is a girl who's a neuroscientist. She's originally from Iran. I think she was from Iran, and she's been in the United States forever. She said that her mom used to use these, I think it was the tea, like reading the mm-hmm. dregs left over in the bottom of the teacup. Mm-hmm. And she's like, there were too many times as a kid that my mom was spot on about things in that way. And so she's like, then I go on and I become a neuroscientist. And, you know, the rigor in neuroscience is physical materialism. You know, these powers of the mind, et cetera, they don't exist according to the dogma. But she's like, I went into it knowing actually that it does exist. So we're having more and more of these people who are getting the sorts of degrees and credentials and then going out and doing the experiments from an inside out sort of perspective, who are contributing now and getting this information into the pipeline. And it is slowly changing things, but it is still true what, there was a Nobel Prize, very famous scientist back in the day. It might have been Max Planck, who said that the progress in science happens one funeral at a time, because you'll have the old guard who make a career out of putting forth certain theories and ideas, and it becomes the dogma for the field. And then they spend the rest of their careers, the rest of their lives, defending that original position, even when new information comes along that might contradict what they believe to be true. There might be better science that comes along that comes up with different results, but they won't allow that to become acceptable. And while there, it's like, over my cold dead body, well, you know, all right, now here's, and so the joke is that, you know, science progresses one funeral at a time, because once these people are no longer here to influence the rest of their colleagues, you get the younger generations who've come up with a different idea about how this works and with a different idea about the science, and they come along and they're actually able to take the baton and run forward with it. But that's why science can be so slow sometimes to accept things that are contradictory to what's been established already.
Well, I like where you start out with the the levitation. There's a two diametrically opposed. One who is basically a monk and a clean living kind of guy, and the other one who's totally not. but they're both able to levitate, okay? So I like the diametrically opposed juxtaposition of this guy is a clean living kind of guy, and not only that, he would fast for 40 days. Okay, that's impressive, but kept himself extremely light, no baggage. And then the other guy who had pretty much every bag you could attach. Okay, so go into that.
So you have people like Joseph of Cupertino. He was known as the Flying Friar, and he was an ascetic. He would fast for 40 days at a time, sometimes multiple times in a year. He did the self-flagellation. You know, he was really into these very disciplined spiritual practices. He would spend hours in his little monk cell in prayer. He was also a priest, so he could go and enact the rituals of the Catholic Church. And there were, I mean, when I looked into this, I mean, I'd heard of him, but I didn't know that during his Inquisition trial, that all of this data was gathered about him, that people gave sworn depositions. The Pope himself said that he witnessed this man levitating. Now, yes, it happened 6 centuries ago, or however long ago it was. It was, you know, back during the Dark Ages and witch burnings and, you know, the Inquisition and all that, which almost got him. I mean, the Inquisition came after him too, because he was doing things that they said was of the devil. And ultimately, like when you read the trial records, they weren't trying to dispute that he actually levitated. They were trying to, at least his accusers were trying to say that this wasn't some power of God, that this was some power of, you know, of evil. So you've got those records, and there were, I mean, I think it was 150 different witnesses who were deposed for his Inquisition trial. And some of them were, they were diplomats and scientists and other priests and, you know, high church officials, cardinals, bishops, I mean, and even a pope, who said that they witnessed it happen personally with their own eyes. Not that they were told about it by someone else, but they were there when it happened. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the PK man, who was one of the most, Ted Owens was one of the most outrageous characters in all of the literature, because he started off as, he knew that he could do these things. He had a very violent father, and eventually his grandfather ended up raising him. His great-grandmother was a psychic reader. His grandfather was a dowser. And he grew up in this rural area, I think in Texas, where, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, there isn't much else to do. So, you know, he's practicing these things with his mind. He became adept at being able to, like, memorize entire magazines. He could read a magazine and then tell you, like, word for word what it says. And he could do it all from memory. The IQ test qualified him for Mensa, which means the man was a certified genius before he ever even came on the scene as this man who could demonstrate psychokinesis. So he ends up at the Duke lab, the parapsychology lab at Duke University, which was run by J.B. Rhine and his wife, Lisa, both of them PhD botanists out of, or I don't know if they're botanists, but I know they're both PhDs from the University of Chicago. So very academically rigorous school, very much into trying to prove that these things actually could happen, such as influencing dice rolls. Ted Owens ended up there. He shows up at the door one day and he's like, I hear that you're looking for the test psychics. He ends up becoming a clerk with the lab. He ends up working there for a while and then going off and doing, you know, branching off and doing his own thing. One of the really fascinating things about Ted is just that he knew that he could do these things, and he was trying to prove it to others, but he encountered so much derision, you know, the ostracism, the social sort of like, you know, look at Ted Owens over there. Who does he think he is? He must be crazy. He thinks that he can influence things with his mind, even though he had demonstrated it to himself and done it to others. He got really, really into trying to prove to people that he could really do these things. So you look into his case, and if you just hear about it, it's easy to dismiss. But then you start looking into the people who said that they were part of what happened. They either witnessed it or were kind of on the receiving end of sometimes when he would get mad about things, you know. And he got mad at the National Tattler. It was like this rag tabloid, you know, kind of like the National Enquirer. I think they called it the Tattler. He got mad at them about a way that something that they wrote about him or didn't write about him, but he was mad at him. And he's like, I'm going to send a hurricane to your offices in like Miami, Florida. And you just watch, I'm going to get you guys. And they're all laughing. And the next thing you know, there's this Category 5 hurricane that comes blowing in out of the Caribbean. And they're like, wait a minute, how did this happen? You know, and there's Ted going, I told you so. So one of the reporters calls him up and says, Ted, if this city gets hit by that hurricane, this is going to be catastrophic. You might have a beef with us about what we wrote about you or what we didn't write about you. But do all these other people have to pay for it? Because, you know, this isn't right. And he said, okay, I agree with you. And he gets off the phone, and next thing you know, that hurricane is going in another direction. Of course, it went and clobbered the Dominican Republic after that, and, you know, those poor people paid the price for it. But yeah, Ted was, he was a heavy drinker. He liked to watch football. He said he could even influence games by getting guys to fumble, that he could focus on a team if he didn't like the team. And Wendy, this was one of the really interesting, fascinating things I found as I was researching it. There was a letter from the owner of one of the football teams that Ted had a beef with and was publicly saying, he was writing to all these sports journalists and stuff like that saying, I'm Ted Owens and I can make this team lose by using the power of my mind. And I'm going to show you because this Sunday they're going to lose and it's going to look bad. And it would happen exactly the way that he predicted. And there's actually a letter from the president of one of the football teams to Ted, basically trying to make amends. like, Ted, we recognize, you know, we hope that you'll accept this Chicago Bears jersey as our token of appreciation and affection for you. And please don't screw with our team anymore. So there were apparently people who were on the receiving end who witnessed these things and found it was better to keep Ted on your side rather than against you.
Yes, absolutely. There's a plain story with a lightning strike that's even more interesting. That's the thing about this, though. You go through and you do try to corroborate whatever you can with the science and the background on that. But the people that you've included, the stories, I think, speak for themselves, because this gives us some kind of an indication that these abilities are throughout the population. You don't have to be somebody educated or somebody indigenous to be able to do this kind of event. It's part of who we are as humans.
No, I think it's wired into the nervous system. I think this is a capacity that the nervous system has. And the people who are demonstrating it now are sort of ahead of the curve, and that this is gradually working its way back into the curve. You know, if you think of the bell curve, you know, the average person right now can do these things like remote viewing. They can get results that would be affirmative enough that they would at least prove it for themselves. If they could be tested over and over again, maybe they could accumulate the kind of data that a scientist would look at and say, actually, there is good statistical evidence here that whatever this person is claiming to do with this power of the mind, they are actually doing. But there are people who are ahead of the curve in this sense. And there was a guy named, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Itzhak Bentov. He wrote a book called Stalking the Wild Pendulum. His thing was about awakening the kundalini energy in the nervous system. And he said that people who are able to do these things are ahead of the curve, but that the evolution of humanity is bringing us all in this direction, where these things will become accepted. But as I got into it and I found that there was plenty of evidence for the existence of these things, but that the scientific community in general was very dead set against it, vehemently sometimes. I mean, people's careers have ended for suggesting that there might be some validity to this. You know, I mean, if you just look at what they did to Brian Josephson, and Rupert Sheldrake, I mean, they have endured decades of schoolyard taunting and derision from their colleagues. And Wendy, it made me think that maybe there is a sort of agenda at work here to try to keep this from becoming mainstream acceptable. Whoever they are, somebody, something out there knows that these abilities are built into the nervous system, that anybody can do it. Some people are born with that capacity already burning bright in them, and some people have to develop it with practice. But it's real. And there seems to be an agenda to try to hide that fact from the public.
You've included Michael Persinger, where he says, goes into "There Are No Secrets," which is also what Ingo Swann suggests. People who are highly psychic, they are a threat, because if they know what you're thinking and you have an agenda that might be a military, you know, you're looking to keep something secret, something hidden, and there's this person who knows, well, what do you do? What do you do with that person? What do you do with a community or a population that has these abilities? And my goal is to basically continue to bring this to people's awareness that we are not at this point at our A game with the psychic abilities, but we have the potential to be so much more than we currently are, because it's just part of who we are. And when we're told it doesn't exist, well, then we might back away. But when we're told, here's what you can do, then a lot of people get excited and curious and creative. And they're like, wow, okay, if I can do this, then what else can I do? And that's it. What you are helping with is basically highlighting what the skeptics are overlooking, that real people are quietly doing the impossible. Imagine that.
Yes. And I want to add to that, that if you hear the word debunk, then what you're seeing is somebody's ideologically driven screed against something. They say, well, this doesn't exist, and we're going to debunk it. So they've done it to Rupert Sheldrake by deplatforming him. They also did it to Russell Targ. He had a TED talk that got, you know, taken down. You can still find it, but it required people to grab their home copies of it and use their personal accounts to put it back up. So there was an agenda to actually remove this information from the public eye. And part of it is probably that these intelligence agencies and military organizations and stuff who've been operational with this stuff for decades realized a long time ago what Michael Persinger said in that video. There are no secrets anymore because we have people who have demonstrated that they can find out anything they want to simply using their mind and a protocol such as remote viewing. It was proven starting back in the 1970s. I didn't use this in the book because it's kind of an apocryphal story. It wasn't written up in a journal, so it's hard to sometimes present some of these really wild claims. But Pat Price, he was one of the remote viewers from the early days. Pat Price was tested and was able to read the file names inside of a super secret vault in a facility from the National Security Agency. He read the file names using just the protocols of remote viewing. So Pat is hundreds or thousands of miles away, and there is a safe. It's tall as a person, super thick, super secret, kept inside of a super secret facility. There is no way he could have physically seen it with his own eyes. And yet he demonstrated this. And when the results got back to the people in Washington, they said that the next day that all of these, you know, national security goons showed up at SRI wondering,
they were angry.
Do we have a national security look?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, do we have a national security leak here? You know, so there is something, I can see that as being one of the reasons why this stuff has been kept under wraps. And I started connecting the dots with what we've also seen with the UFO UAP. The evidence has been there for decades, and yet there was this cloud of doubt and suspicion that was cast over it, which is basically a disinformation campaign, a deliberate attempt by the people who were trying to keep the secret. And whether that secret is that, you know, we really are being visited by some kind of civilization intelligence on, you know, from out there somewhere that has technology that's way beyond theirs, ours, or it's that this is our own technology that's being witnessed and seen, that there's some group or groups with the super deep into the black budget world, the black world of military ops and intelligence agencies and stuff like that, who are trying to keep the lid on the fact that they've actually developed technology that can fly around the sky like a flying saucer.
Considering the pilots and the people who have the tech background saying, not in this lifetime are we capable of doing what I've seen them do in the sky. I mean, that I love I love that part. When you actually get somebody who has the authority and possibly the clearance to have seen some of the current capabilities of our military and others, and then saying, look, guys, this is really incredible, and maybe, and that's what they're coming out saying right now, that I've never seen anything that has the capability of what we have witnessed. And they're finally saying, because so many people are saying it worldwide, this is global, this isn't just our UFO UAP project, this is something that's been going on for decades, and finally saying, yeah, we can't keep it secret anymore because too many people are coming forward saying we see it and it is a military threat. That's the big one.
And the same sort of cloud, you're seeing the same playbook with that issue playing out with the psychic abilities and functioning. They use the same way of creating and sowing doubt. And it makes me wonder if it's not for the same reason, because they could either have an advantage because they've developed these programs, such as remote viewing, and they don't want the word to get out. I mean, it already is.
Yeah.
But for years, for decades, they were trying to keep this information under wraps. So when I look at this and I go, there is obviously some kind of agenda at work here because the evidence is right there in front of our faces. And yet when you hear about it on the evening news, and it's the subject of UFOs, it still comes with the snickers and the joke, you'll still get that sort of, social cloud of doubt around it, of derision and making fun of it around both of these subjects. So it tells me that there's someone who is perhaps trying to keep a secret to keep this information from getting out there in the general public. That is one of the things I wanted to do with the book, is to show the readers that A, the evidence is there from traditional science. B, the evidence is there from personal accounts, people who have witnessed these things for themselves and are highly credible witnesses. And C, that there is actually an active campaign to try to keep this information under wraps. To me, that is a real crime. I mean, it's all a crime, but ultimately what it's doing is it's scaring people off from what is probably a natural capacity, a sort of sixth sense of the nervous system. At least with some of these things we're talking about as being paranormal, they are being generated internally between the person and their environment. The person's internal state is affecting their environment.
Yes.
In these various ways. I mean, when I looked into the poltergeist literature and how many times did they find when they investigated poltergeist cases that there was somebody in the home who was deeply emotionally troubled, and that these poltergeist phenomena, things flying across the room, fires starting, scratches, that these were being associated with the emotional turmoil of a person who was living in the home. And the researchers would be like, yeah, they went off to see their aunt for 2 weeks and the house was as quiet as can be. And as soon as that person stepped back into the home, the crap started hitting the fan again. I mean, Wendy, they had the one case where the three researchers were in the home and they experienced feces manifesting inside the home and raining down from the ceiling. And there were three investigators from SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, one of the oldest and most prestigious organizations for studying this stuff. They had three researchers in the home who all said that it happened. It's written up. It's in the literature. They published it. So, tell me that didn't happen. Anyway, the point being is that people have this capacity. It's been demonstrated over and over again. And it seems like that we're being scared away from it. But on the one hand, there's a fascination with it because we see all these depictions of it in movies and television and stuff. And you might see a show where they have a psychic detective or something. And you're like, wow, that sounds really interesting. I wonder if I could do that. And just the average viewer, it kind of lights a little bit of an interest in them. But then they get out into the information they're getting from other sources where they say, well, people who believe they can do these kinds of things are crazy and they should be locked up or on medicine or whatever. And you're like, oh, yeah, do I want to be associated with that? Is that how I want people to think of me? Do I want to put myself in that kind of danger by putting myself out there because I can do these things too, or I might be interested in developing the abilities? And that scares people away from doing it.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the real crime is being committed, because this is our birthright. This is something that's built into all of us. And we need to claim that birthright, but we're being scared away.
Well, I like the other topics you also include. There are two absolutely astounding reincarnation cases, Robert Snow and Jeffrey Keane. And they are textbook for what can happen when you really start connecting the dots of, did I have a past life? And these guys, they even, down to Jeffrey Keane, the look, his image is absolutely extraordinary when you look at his past life picture and his present life picture. And so I'm glad you pulled those two guys in because their stories are incredible.
Well, I know Jeff personally, and because he's a contributor at the Reincarnation and Past Lives subreddits, where I've been a moderator there for years. And when I ran across his account, so for the listeners, this is in a nutshell. Jeffrey Keane was a firefighter in Connecticut. He worked his way up to assistant fire chief, very good at his job, was on a sort of a vacation sort of thing where he was with his wife, and he decided he wanted to visit the Civil War battlefield at Antietam. Now, a lot of people, tens of thousands of soldiers died there in a massive Civil War battle. He said that he got down, they call it the Sunken Road. It was the place that back, it's a road now, but it was the trenches that they had built for the Confederate soldier. He said that when he walked past this certain place, that he felt this just sort of overwhelming power of just overwhelming grief and emotion just filled him. It knocked the breath out of him, knocked him to his knees. He's like, what in the world just happened? Well, he started investigating what had happened on the battlefield. He ran across this general named John B. Gordon. And Gordon looks a lot like Jeffrey. I mean, you see the pictures, and there's one in the book where you see him side by side. Like, yeah, they could be identical twins. They even have the same, Jeff has a birthmark on his face where Gordon took a bullet through his jaw. And it turned out that it happened on that spot or close to the spot where Jeff was walking, unsuspecting, had no idea, just a tourist on a Civil War battlefield. He said that that was the spot where Gordon had been shot and really, by all rights, should have died. But he came back. So Jeff did all of this research, and he went from being somebody who had no idea about past lives. I mean, you know, everybody's heard of reincarnation, but Jeff was not raised in that environment. He wasn't raised to believe these things. He didn't believe it, but he had the experience that convinced him. And that was the same thing that happened to Bob Snow. Detective Bob Snow was a homicide investigator in Indianapolis. He eventually was the head of, like, he was the police captain, the homicide police captain. He ran the homicide division. He and I tell the story in the book. There was a police psychologist who asked him at a social occasion, hey, have you ever heard of past life regression? And Bob, being, you know, the staunch materialist, you know, big time skeptic that he was, kind of made fun of her or the whole idea of it. You know, oh yeah, past life regression, that's all a bunch of crap. People making themselves believe things that aren't true. And by the way, I could never be hypnotized because I'm too good for that. You know, I'm Bob Snow. I'm a homicide investigator. Yeah. You're not pulling one over on me. So the police psychologist says, well, why don't you find out for yourself? I mean, you're a detective and you want to find out the truth, right? And so she eventually wrangled him into having a past life regression session where he came up with, and I'm going to pull the number off the top of my head, I believe it was 28 different things about the past life that he saw during hypnosis of this artist. And he came up with all of this information about this artist that he didn't know the guy's name. He just was like, wait, that's me. I'm seeing from the perspective of this man through his eyes and experiencing his life and this man's marriage and his feelings about, like, having to paint portraits, which he hated doing, but he needed the money. You know, he saw facts about, well, you know, the way that his wife died, he's about where he was when he died. Bob then used his detective skills. He said, if I can disprove any of this, then I've just debunked the whole thing. So he went off and tried to do it. And the more he looked into it, the more that he was actually going the other direction. His skills as a homicide investigator actually confirmed the information that he got through his past life regression hypnosis session, to a point where it was this dramatic thing where he found the picture that he painted as Carol Beckwith. This was the artist that he was way back in the day. He found the picture that he saw under hypnosis. He saw himself painting this picture of a hunchback woman And then he found it in an obscure art gallery while he was on vacation with his wife for their anniversary when they were out of town in New Orleans. And he found the very picture that he painted. And that was the moment when he realized it's all true. So when you put that together with the science that's been done by others, such as at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia, you had Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker. They're the big names, but then there's others out there who've been doing this research too, of trying to verify supposed reincarnation cases. And I couldn't believe when I found out that there were 2,700 cases in their files that they flew all over the world when they would hear about these cases where, you know, well, we've got this child in Pakistan who has a big birthmark across their head, and they said they were murdered by somebody who, you know, chopped them up with an axe, and that they can identify, you know, like 3-year-old, 4-year-old child who's talking about this past life and has the physical birthmarks to go with the memories, and then they go and they verify it. When you look at how they did that and they set it up under as rigorous as you can be with this kind of stuff is scientifically, and you put that together with the stories from people like Jeff and Bob Snow, I think that it makes a very compelling case. So yes, there's a chapter on the science of reincarnation, a chapter on the science of precognitive and other types of dreams. We've got telepathy, psychokinesis, remote viewing, kind of runs the gamut, levitation, of these things that have been studied, written about, witnessed. Now I put it together in a book that creates a nice narrative of like, hey, do you want to know what the truth is? Do you want to see what the science has to say, what the published research has to say? And oh, by the way, I have all these other people who have given sworn accounts of what they experienced. And if any of this stuff is true, if we can prove even one of these things as being real, then we have just nulled the hypothesis that none of it is real, because we can actually prove it now. We can prove at least, if we can prove even one of these things. And I think that it's been proven beyond a doubt in some cases. Like remote viewing is absolutely a real thing. Remote viewing is a protocol for a psychic function or ability called clairvoyance. So the remote viewing is just the protocol for tapping into the mind's ability to be able to remotely sense distant locations without using traditional means. It's been demonstrated conclusively. There have been studies that have been published in Nature and IEEE. These aren't fringe journals. You know, now, was there a huge blowback after they published this stuff? Yes, there was. You know, but when you read what the blowback is, the critics, the skeptics, what you find basically at the heart of their argument is, well, none of this could be true because it's impossible according to our paradigm. They don't really go off and run their own experiments. What they do is they find ways of criticizing other people's experiments to create a cloud of suspicion around it. This is what happened with Daryl Bem. He's a sociologist, University of Illinois, tenured professor, was very highly regarded before he retired. He was one of the top sociologists in this field. He ran these precognition studies. He came up with outstanding results. And when he published it, the initial reaction was, oh my God, who let this guy in? The reaction from the skeptics was just apocalyptic. They found something to chew on, which was that the original replication studies were not able to replicate his results. So the headline said, Bem's study has been debunked. And then attention moves on elsewhere. Nobody comes back and revisits it. Well, guess what? Other labs continued trying to run his, you know, experiments under his protocols. They published their research. And after the initial wave of replications that failed, you had replications that succeeded. But Wendy, did you hear about the headlines? Did you see that on evening news?
Heck no.
Did you see the skeptics coming back and saying, oops. Yeah, I mean, the skeptics didn't revisit it. They said, well, we proved our point. And it's like, well, no, actually you didn't. What you did is you jumped on something that concerned that it's like your own confirmation bias. You're doing the very things that you accuse the parapsychologists of doing. You accuse them of having a confirmation bias. Well, they believe this stuff to be true, and they'll do anything to make us, you know, to pull the wool over our eyes. Well, they're actually doing the same thing, but they're not actually digging into the literature. When you actually read the literature, then you come away with a very different perception.
Part 1, J.M. DeBoard, author of The Science of the Paranormal, The Truth Behind Telepathy, ESP, Reincarnation, and More Mysterious Phenomena. You can also check out the website, jmdebord.com. In the next segment, dowsing.
If we can prove even one of these things as being real, then we have just nulled the hypothesis that none of it is real, because we can actually prove it now.
Thanks for listening.